It's Friday, April 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, we look at the migrant situation in Greece. Vietnam has a new prime minister. An analyst comments on the country's leadership.
They've just put at least four or five bloggers in jail, imprisoned them after very brief trials.
And country music stars react to the death of singer Merle Haggard. It's all ahead. The second group of migrants to be returned under a controversial new European Union deal with Turkey has reached Akili, Turkey. The migrants arrived following a short journey from the camp where they were staying on the Greek island of Lesbos. The group is comprised of 45 Pakistani migrants. A Turkish ferry brought the migrants to port Friday to be followed later in the day by about 80 more migrants. Greek officials say none of those sent to Turkey had applied for asylum in the European Union. EU officials said Wednesday that all migrants facing deportation would be given a chance to apply for asylum, and those who are denied are promised 5 days to appeal. As preparations were made for the migrants to leave Lesbos Friday, at least two activists were arrested after jumping into the water and clinging to the heavy chain connected to the ferry's anchor. The activists working to stop the deportations say the migrants cannot be assured good treatment in Turkey, which has a poor human rights record. I spoke with VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch, who's currently in Athens reporting on the migrant situation there. And I asked her to describe the plight of the migrants in the Greek capital.
Well, there's, I think, thousands of migrants, refugees stranded on the ports here. They're all camped out on the port. The border to Macedonia, it remains closed, so there's not a huge great reason for them to head north and join a dire humanitarian situation on that border. However, the government says they want this port to be cleared and they want people to leave and to go to regular camps that are supervised by government. The problem is that these camps, first of all, the one that most of them believe they'll go to is considered quite dangerous. People tell me they were at that camp for a couple of days and foxes and snakes entered their tents and it was very dangerous for the children. The other thing is that when they get to a camp, they cannot control if the camp will be called an open camp or a closed camp. A closed camp means that the people, once they go inside, are not necessarily allowed out. Also, recently, some camps have been open and suddenly closed, so all the people who think they're in a refugee camp are suddenly in a detention center. So people are afraid of that, too.
Do you know which countries these migrants are from?
Well, that's what I'm talking to today. A lot of them have been from Syria. We've seen some from Iraq, many people from Afghanistan. I met one person who was from an Arab part of Iran, and he told me that he felt abused and threatened in the part of Iran he lived in. In other parts of Greece, I've seen lots of people from Bangladesh and Pakistan and Morocco and Algeria. And, of course, everywhere we go, we see people from Syria.
Now, you were just a couple of days ago, you were in the island of Lesbos. What is the situation? Now, it was a couple of days ago. What was the situation there like?
Well, they started deporting people from Lesbos at the beginning of the week. The first transport was on Monday. The next one was just this morning. Two boats at least went out. There's a lot of fear on Lesbos because, for starters, thousands of people are inside a camp that did turn into a detention center on March 20th. And the people there have been told that possibly they might be deported or they can apply for asylum in Greece. Now, inside that camp, people are afraid to apply for asylum because they're not sure if they're going to be held in a detention center if they get asylum. Outside the camp, there are some, not a whole lot, but there are some refugees living in makeshift areas that they can come and go from, but they get very little assistance. Those people, often Pakistanis, want the right to apply for asylum, and they say, although the EU says they do have that right, if they try, they get arrested and they get deported. And as I'm sure you know, Pakistani people have been deported from Lesbos for a while, even before the EU deal.
That's VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch in Athens. Joining me is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending today. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, the fallout from these Panama Papers continues, and specifically today for British Prime Minister David Cameron. Now, earlier this week, he said, I'm not involved with this at all, and throughout the course of the week kind of had to backtrack until today when he finally admitted that his late father had set up an offshore account, I guess, through this law firm involved with the Panama Papers. So now we have trending atop Twitter, hashtag resign Cameron. A lot of people saying that because they feel covered up this information or wasn't forthcoming with the information about his personal finances, that he should resign. So there's a lot of anger on Twitter, a lot of memes being shared, of course. Jokesters always kind of seize on these things and try to make jokes about at the person's expense. And we'll see if this has an impact. We'll see if this maybe pushes him, if not to resign, at least to address this outcry on social media. But a lot of unhappy people, and not just in the UK, around the world, saying, look at this guy who's supposed to be fighting for financial transparency and all of these things that he promised when he came into office, and he's letting his country down and really the world down, is their argument.
Yeah, a lot of questions there.
Yeah, so we'll see how that develops. But the other story trending today, chatbots. Now, this is, if you go online, if you make flight reservations or something, and you get the little pop-up window that says, would you like to talk to somebody?
Oh.
And you chat back and forth with them about, adjusting your reservation or whatnot. Well, it's usually actually a robot that's doing that, and it's someone kind of supervising it, but a lot of it is automated. Well, Facebook is trying to get in on this. They announced last week that they wanted to use their Messenger app to allow people to do things like book flights or talk to customer service representatives, and it looks like they're going to be embracing this chatbot feature their messaging service to do that. So we'll see how that plays out, how that gets implemented, and whether it works successfully for them. But lots of people noting this is the new age that we live in. The robots may be taking over, at least as far as making reservations for flights and things like that.
They'll get some of the complaints, too.
Yes, well, that's the thing I think a lot of people are maybe happy about, saying, at least I don't have to deal with the complaints. It'll let a robot deal with that.
All right, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Canadian researchers have found that nonverbal human sounds of emotion, such as a scream of anger or alarm, a cry of sadness, or a laugh of joy, are able to better communicate feelings than spoken words. Writing in a study published by the journal Biological Psychology, the scientists from Montreal's McGill University also discovered that our brains respond in just 1/10 of a second to these non-spoken vocalizations. They say our ability to quickly recognize the non-spoken sounds of emotion was a matter of human survival long before language was developed. Working with 24 research subjects, the scientists found that sounds of happiness, like laughter, registered quicker with the volunteers than sounds of sadness or anger. But angry sounds and speech produced longer-lasting brain activity in their subjects' brains than either happiness or sadness. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, African immigrant women, entrepreneurs here in the United States, comment on their presidential choices. This week, Vietnam completed a change in its top leadership with the approval of 62-year-old Nguyen Xuân Phúc as Prime Minister by the National Assembly.
Thưa Quốc hội, tôi xin trân trọng cảm ơn Quốc hội.
He thanked the Assembly for their vote of confidence and swore absolute loyalty to the country, the people, and the Constitution. He vowed to continue with economic reforms and to combat corruption. Completing Vietnam's political leadership, Communist Party leader Nguyen Phu Chau was re-elected in January as Secretary General. Last Saturday, Chuan Duy Quan was approved as president. They face soaring public debt, a budget deficit, and China's growing assertiveness in the South China Sea. Vietnam analyst, Professor Emeritus, and consultant Carl Thayer tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the new prime minister hails from central Vietnam and spent his adult life rising through the ranks of the communist hierarchy.
Most of his career until about 2011, well, in fact, all of it except for some study, was based in provincial administration, rising up through the ranks of both the party and the local government there. And then in 2011, he got elected to the Central Committee, was put in charge of the government office, in other words, the person who ran the business of cabinet for the prime minister, then was made one of the deputy prime ministers. And then when the 12th Party Congress that met in January decided to retire the current prime minister of Vietnam, Nguyen Xuân Phúc, was chosen to succeed him.
He, in a speech, vowed to continue with reform, fight corruption, and defend the country's sovereignty. Is that about what you expected?
Yes, I think, in fact, that's the pattern when they just elected the president of the country. He said the same thing about sovereignty. That's a key issue. The retiring prime minister had gone out in the front on that, and it was sometimes seen that he was more advanced. But it's such a hot issue across Vietnam that no politician can do anything other than say they're going to defend Vietnamese sovereignty.
Well, Vietnam now has a new triumvirate at the head of government. What direction, if any, change might occur in Vietnam?
Well, for the most part, the very broad economic policies have been set. They released a five-year socioeconomic plan that's a product of interagency action. And it's to meet the issue of public debt, unperforming loans issued by state banks to the state-owned enterprises. That's key, controlling inflation, getting a growth rate around just over 6.7%, and at the end of this five-year period, creating a middle-income country from Vietnam. That said, foreign policy, likewise, Vietnam is not going to veer in a line with any one country. It tries to maintain a multipolar balance. That's a difficult act because, as they have these problems with China that you've alluded to, they've just put at least four or five bloggers in jail, imprisoned them after very brief trials, which is not going to endear them to the United States, especially since President Obama is due there in May.
Carl Thayer says, given his relative junior status, he doesn't expect the new prime minister to engage in any new initiatives for at least the first 2 years of his five-year term. He says the communist-ruled country has evolved in recent years, adopting a constitution in 1992 and requiring all constituencies to have multiple candidates to run for office. Thayer says independent candidates are expected to test the government's commitment to reform by seeking candidacies in what is normally a tightly controlled process in national assemblies next month at about the same time President Obama arrives in the country for a state visit. Well, if the U.S. presidential campaign were to come down to Republican Donald Trump versus Democrat Hillary Clinton, 60% of American women polled in a recent CNN survey said they would cast their ballots for Clinton. As candidates reach out to women voters, VOA correspondent Aru Pandey talks to female African immigrant entrepreneurs on the challenges of starting a woman-owned small business and whom they support come November.
As a woman, who'd have thought? I come from Africa, you know, I would have thought that I would start a business in America, you know?
The last year has not been without its challenges for ice cream shop owner Ann Siegel. The Ugandan-American and mother of a young daughter used her family's savings to get her year-old Laurel, Maryland business off the ground.
It's so easy for a man to go to the bank and they give him a loan. Me, a woman, what do you do? Oh, I'm a housewife. Oh, yeah, really? Nobody's going to give you a loan, you know.
Margot Dorfman, CEO of the U.S. Women's Chamber of Commerce, says the challenges of being a female business owner are reflected in the statistics. While women own 36% of all U.S. companies, they generate only 4% of all U.S. annual revenues.
We have been undervalued for decades now. The fact that we still don't have fair pay, we have to leave corporate America to start our own businesses, to maybe get fair pay and the family-friendly work environment, and still struggle when we've got into the marketplace.
On who might best address the struggle, Dorfman says Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton wins her organization's endorsement.
She is committed to making sure that small businesses have access to capital and access to markets, and is very interested in the access to affordable health care.
Buki Openuga, a fellow Clinton supporter, grew her Atlanta-based digital marketing company using high-interest credit cards. In the presidential campaign, the Nigerian-American says she is paying close attention to women's workplace issues.
Some people don't necessarily want to go the entrepreneurial route, but they're having to essentially come out of the workplace and become 1099 workers because they're having to choose between a paycheck or being able to take care of a sick child at home. So these are some of the issues that I think I'm going to be paying attention to, and a lot of women really should.
Back in Maryland, Ann Siegel is paying close attention to the economy as she works to make her shop profitable. Though she voted for Barack Obama, she says she's disappointed with Democrats and is now looking in a different direction.
Who is Trump? He's created a job. You know, he's employing people. When it comes to economy, at least he knows better than the other guys who are running around telling us what to do.
Regardless of whom they support, both Siegel and Opunuga say American women should ensure their voices are heard come November. Arup Pandey, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
It's been a volatile week for country music. After basking in the afterglow of the Academy of Country Music Awards, country music lovers were then devastated by the loss of one of its mighty patriarchs, Merle Haggard. On April 6, 2016, his 79th birthday, Merle Haggard passed away from pneumonia. Nikki Strong of VOA Music is here to talk about the ACM Awards and country music's response to Haggard's passing. So, Nikki, is it difficult to talk about the ACM Awards? I mean, it pales in comparison to the death of Merle Haggard.
Well, yeah, it is and it isn't. Merle Haggard helped inform so much of the music and so many of the artists in country music today. And so when people talk about country music, one of the first things that comes to mind is lyrics and storytelling, the songwriting. And he was one of the absolute best at it. He's one of the biggest influences that so many artists reference or point to when it comes to, you know, traditional, authentic country music. And country music traditionalists in particular were big winners at the ACM Awards. Chris Stapleton represents that aesthetic, and the fact that he did so well, winning 6 trophies, including Album and Song of the Year, speaks to the strength of the legacy that Merle Haggard, one of Chris's early influences, helped to craft.
Well, now, Merle Haggard was not a big fan of modern country music.
No, he wasn't. And he was very vocal about it, too, especially bro country. You know, and there's a quote where he says, "I can't tell what they're doing. They're talking about screwing on a pickup tailgate and things of that nature. I don't find no substance. I don't find anything you can whistle, and nobody even attempts to write a melody. It's more of that kid stuff. It's hot right now, but I'll tell you what, it's cooling off."
Well, so Merle must have been happy about Chris Stapleton's success.
I think that is very safe to say, yes.
Well, still many artists, both contemporary and traditional, express their remorse and appreciation for the impact Merle Haggard had on country music.
Most definitely. Many artists inside and outside of country music as well. Many artists, different artists, including Joan Baez and the Grateful Dead, covered Merle's music. And many people took to Twitter to express their remorse. I know Brad Paisley wrote, "There are no words to describe the loss and sorrow felt within all of music with the passing of Merle Haggard. Thank God for his life and songs." Carrie Underwood wrote, "Love and prayers for the Haggard family. Merle was a pioneer, a true entertainer, a legend. There will never be another like him." Charles Daniels said, "Country music has suffered one of the greatest losses it will ever experience. Rest in peace." And Travis Tritt, he said, "He was more than a great talent. He was a gifted poet. What a huge inspiration he was to everyone." Larry King, he said, "A bit of Americana dies with Merle Haggard's passing. Storyteller, singer, rebel icon, hero to the common man, and inspiration to many artists. And Willie Nelson, he said he was my brother, my friend. I will miss him.
Yeah, Willie Nelson and Haggard were very close.
Yeah, they were. They were like brothers. I mean, they're icons within the outlaw country music. And the last project that Merle recorded, and he recorded well into, you know, he was touring. He was touring before he passed. So he was very active. And the last project that they did was together with Willie Nelson. It was called Django and Jimmy. It was last year. It was a tribute album to two of their major influences, Django Reinhardt and Jimmy Rogers. And similarly, I anticipate many artists will now pay further tribute to Merle.
Well, you can learn more about Merle Haggard and his music on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. This week's Country Hits show will pay tribute to Merle Haggard's rich legacy. You can also share your thoughts on Haggard on VOA 1's Facebook page at VOA Music. Thank you so much, Nikki.
You're welcome.
The Django and Jimmy, Mississippi, a young singing brickman, a jazz playing gypsy. That might not have been a Merle or Willie, if not for the Django and Jimmy.
That is Merle Haggard and Willie Nelson. And that's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nigeria is a diverse country with a large and assertive civil society, a rich culture, and huge potential. It is a country with an almost boundless capacity for economic growth. And the United States wants Nigeria to succeed. That is why the United States and Nigeria just relaunched the U.S.-Nigeria Binational Commission with a high-level strategic dialogue in Washington designed to expand mutual cooperation across a broad range of shared interests. The United States, said Secretary of State John Kerry at the Commission's most recent meeting in late March, is encouraged that under new President Muhammadu Buhari, Nigeria has made a commitment to diversify its economy. Secretary Kerry then announced that this year, U.S. aid to Nigeria will top $600 million. A significant portion of this money will go toward halting the misery that is spread by HIV/AIDS, by malaria, and by TB. More funding will go towards strengthening Nigeria's energy sector through President Obama's Power Africa initiative, and the Feed the Future program will help improve agricultural efficiency and raise rural incomes. Together, said Secretary of State Kerry, we will work to address humanitarian and development needs, especially in the country's north, where the lack of opportunity has been holding people back, and where the terrorist organization Boko Haram has murdered thousands and disrupted the lives of millions. Thus, the United States will support Nigeria's efforts to once and for all defeat Boko Haram and to eliminate the conditions that have seen the genesis of this terrorist group and that aid its recruitment and operations. These include effective governance, the creation of good jobs, and the elimination of corruption. Our purpose, said Secretary of State Kerry, is to map out the next steps for cooperation in all of those areas where we need it. This doesn't transform things overnight. But, he said, it moves us steadily forward. It creates momentum in the right direction, and that is good for Nigeria. It's good for the United States, and frankly, if we can get this right, that will really make a difference to the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.